Welcome to the Forency Podcast. Forency.us is a language training website for Hebrew, Arabic, and Russian designed specifically for intermediate to advanced learners. Our daily lessons prepare you to read real foreign language news articles and listen to actual foreign language media on a wide variety of subjects to put you on the path to language mastery. If you're studying Hebrew, Arabic, or Russian, you can visit our site at forency.us. That's foreign.cy.us. And enter the promo code Language Mastery for a 10% discount on our annual and six-month subscriptions. I had the honor of speaking with Dr. Ruvik Rosenthal today, who's a prize-winning author and linguist in Israel. He's an expert on the Hebrew language, Hebrew linguistics, and he's written a number of works over the years on that topic, from Hebrew slang and idioms to military slang. And he's also an accomplished author of children's and other books as well. His website is www.ruvik.co.il, where you can access all of his articles and blog posts and questions that he answers daily on the Hebrew language that he receives from people in Israel and around the world. We touched on a number of topics in this podcast, from Hebrew language history to his career and his passion and his personal thoughts on the language. And I'm calling this podcast part one because without any doubt, I need to have a part two to finish all my questions. I have pages of questions that I want to ask him that primarily relate to biblical Hebrew's influence on modern Hebrew. And he has a book coming out within the month that focuses specifically on that topic. And at that point, I hope to have him back on to answer the rest of my questions. But it was one of my favorite podcasts that we've done. He's a truly passionate person and one of the greats when it comes to the Hebrew language and the revival of the Hebrew language and the ongoing evolution and revolution of the Hebrew language. And I hope you enjoy the show. I'm here today with Dr. Ruvik Rosenthal, who's a prize-winning author and linguist in Israel. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you, Alex.
So you've written a number of things, from Hebrew dictionaries, idioms and phrases, slang, military Hebrew, children's books. How did you get into this line of work?
Well, basically, I'm a writer in occupation in what I do and an editor in my profession. And I write since being 10 years old, all the time, all my life. It's a way of living. But along the years, I didn't write about language most of my life. I wrote about various topics. And my first books came out when I was 35. Before that, I wrote a lot, short stories, short essays, and of course, journalistic work. But the love for Hebrew and the passion for Hebrew was very strong. So I studied my BA at the Tel Aviv University. Mm-hmm. Well, I can say modestly that I was very good in it, but I didn't want to be a professional linguist because it didn't fit my temperament, my temper, my wishes to write to the public. And I didn't want to be an expert for a narrow niche. So I left it and I just continued my love, my platonic love to Hebrew.
When you talk about your love for Hebrew, did you feel when you were studying in university and when you thought about going into academia that there was a lack of love in the way that the language is taught?
Not so much in the university. I think I have great teachers, mm-hmm. fortunately. I feel that what made it a big problem and even painful love was the high school studies. Because the high school studies of Hebrew language was very formal, very didactic, very going to, you know, to exams that you have to know what is subject, what is object, what is a root. Right. But without the soul of the language, without, for example, connecting roots with meanings. Roots are arbitrary, but they are not. So if you don't understand that root bears meaning, you don't understand the system. You just have to memorize it, for example, and other things. I even hated my high school language.
I don't think that's extraordinary. I think most people hate high school.
Yes, but some I liked more, and this mm-hmm. I hate. I hated because my passion was hurt. So I was a kibbutz member. It gave me the privilege to go to the university, at 30 years old and not at 20. So I was really ripe to begin my love again. So it succeeded, but it succeeded also because, at least in my time, first degree BA for Hebrew language in Israel was so profound, so rich. So after 3 years, you could know everything you need to understand the language, to know how it works, how it functions, to know its history. And if you want to go to second degree, you have to find to go to a niche, which I didn't want.
How important is the historical aspect of it, of understanding the history of the language and the people speaking it, to learning it?
Well, it's important in every language because a language is dynamic. Language is continue to change along generation. Some languages, we know that they have degrees of change, just leaps, like all the English media, all the stages of English, etc. So if you don't understand these changes, you cannot understand also your current language. But in Hebrew, it's a special story. The special story is based on two aspects. First, it's the only, and really the only, language in the history of languages that was preserved only in text for almost 2,000 years. Was not a spoken language, only in religious aspects or teaching aspects, but not in everyday life. More than that, it was forbidden by the Jews to be an everyday language because it was defined as the Lashon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue.
And can you answer when that started?
Yes. In the Mishnah and Talmud,
the language of the scholars.
We can find even in the Dead Sea Scrolls speaking about the Lashon HaKodesh beginning, but it was stated in some phrases that we have to sanctify the Hebrew language holy because Jews already didn't speak Hebrew.
So already 2,000 years ago during, I guess, Second Temple period times.
After.
So it was already considered around that time.
After the beginning to, we know that there were two dialects in Israel, in what you call now Eretz Israel. The Judaic and the Israeli or Galilee dialect. But only the Judaic was the basic of the Bible, while the Israeli, Galilee, or whatever, it have some names, was only spoken language. But after the fall of the First Temple, the second dialect became the most important, and this is the dialect that the Mishnah was written in.
And to go back to your earlier career writing stories, and what was the source of those stories, and what did you mostly write about?
10 years old, I write, like many children, adventure stories. I have a small book I wrote for myself, of course, not published, not write for anything. And then when I was 12, I decided to go more to journalistic. And I did it for many, many years. And I have the feeling that I'm a journalist and that's my mission. And I love this profession. I love it up to now, though I'm not an active journalist, of course, for many years already.
Right.
Because it's so dynamic. You get up in the morning, you don't know what you're going to write about, etc. And I write for the people. I think what happened was that step by step, I felt that I have to go into more profound, more deep aspects of life. And what make it very crucial was the loss of my only brother in the 73 war. So I began to come deeper to my existence, to my feelings, to the Israeli situation, to the 20th century situation, to the Jewish fate. I didn't think just, well, my brother fell for the country, for the nation, so everything is, you know, falling in order. No, it was not. It is not. I wrote some books, some may say important books, about bereavement, about the war price, what we call the price of the war.
Did that help you cope personally?
No, it was not for coping. It was just for understanding, for writing about what I'm going through. I didn't cope. I didn't want to cope. I want to continue the agony of my brother until my last day.
Right.
And it's part of me. And it's not a problem at all. It's something that empowers me. But I had to write it, and I wrote some. I'm not going into it because it's not my our topics. But I wrote some essays. I wrote documentaries. I wrote a novel. It's called Flowers Street 22, which is a house in Berlin where a story begins. And I go through three generations of my German Jew family.
When you were growing up, did you speak German at home?
Only as a child. Until four years old, I didn't hear Hebrew at home, ever.
And that was pretty common for those days, right? Where the parents still spoke their native tongue in the home, but the children picked up the language.
Every immigrant wave, Olim wave, Aliyot, in Israel, until today, Russian Ethiopians continue to speak at home the language. Most of them, about 90% at least. And most of them even formally say that my main language is the language I used to speak as a child at home before I came to Israel. But it's only one generation. Second generation goes to Hebrew. So the Hebrew succeeded through young people, through schools, through kindergartens. That was the success of the Hebrew revolution,
right.
Even by me. Of course, I knew Hebrew because I was not isolated. But at home, at the street, only German and Yiddish.
What was the first dictionary you wrote or composition of? Your dictionaries aren't strict dictionaries in every sense of the word. You choose very specific topics that and niches that other people aren't doing. What was the first one you did?
The first one was a slang dictionary. But you have to understand that you didn't ask me when did I come back to Hebrew.
When did you come back to Hebrew?
Let's put it in, the timeline. Mm-hmm. In 97, when I was, listen to it, 52 years old, and some people, most of the people say, well, what did I make in life? What was my life? I have some years to continue mm-hmm. it. I began, only began then began it, because I was asked by somebody else to write about language in my newspaper, Ma'ariv. He thought it's a good idea, so I agreed. So then I began to write a column about language in Ma'ariv, a weekly column. The column continued until up to now. It's called close to 1,000 columns, if you can make the math. But after 17 years, Ma'ariv changed ownership. And I left Ma'ariv. I didn't want to continue. And I opened my site. Everybody's invited. Hazira Leshonit.
Ruvik.co.il, I believe.
.co.il. Very, very simple. Which I put not only a new column every week, but also my previous columns, my previous articles, and visitors. People write me about language. Important people.
Right.
And I put it in my site. So it's a kind of journal for, language. From the beginning, I was asked question, how to say that, what is the source of the word or the phrase? So I answer, and I continue to answer about 20, 30 questions. Each question asked, I answer until now. And now in my site. So during writing, I understood what is the main interest of the Hebrew-speaking Israeli. Every time I speak with people, and I speak with many, they say, we love Hebrew. And it's a common saying. Maybe Hebrew is the most loved part of the Israeli culture and the Zionist project. Maybe, I can't say I'm sure, that the most beloved leader of Zionism is Eliezer Ben Yehuda. Mm-hmm. It was checked many times. He is loved, though he was not a lovely person at all. But what do people love? I know what people don't like so much. They don't like syntax. Syntax is, you know, taking the language and restructuring it to very boring ways. Syntax is very important, of course, to research the language or to build the language. But it's not in the interest of the common speaker. I think it's the same everywhere.
Have you ever studied Arabic?
All the time, but only Fusha, only literary right. Arabic, which is a tragedy. We speak about it a lot because we cannot speak with Arabs based on the language we learned. And when you cannot speak, when you cannot use it, you forget even what you learned. But I published some years ago a book which I think I initiated, edited, and worked with a writer, Abid Rahman Mari, about for the book Walab Seder. Walab Seder is a book of the way Arabs, Israeli Arabs, speak now, which includes many Hebrew words and phrases. It's very interesting.
Right.
And I think Arabic is very important. Well, I'm asked, if you want to enlarge it, I'm asked, well, how many languages do you know? So I'm not a polyglot. You know, being a polyglot, you have to be born with it.
Right.
I can learn, study languages if I use them. For example, if I will come to Germany for some months, my German will come back for sure. I know it. English, I use it, so I can speak. But I can understand other languages. I have all the dictionaries and all the stuff I need. So and when you speak, deal with Hebrew, you have to be in touch with almost every language on earth.
So the reason I bring it up is because I've studied both. I've spent years studying Fusha, but also years studying Amiya, which is the spoken dialect. But I bring it up because it's a very similar situation. So formal Arabic is very hard. It's very based on grammar and rules and laws. And then when you go over to dialect, it flows freely. It's a natural experience, and you feel it when you're talking with somebody. But it's a similar thing, I think, with Hebrew when it comes to spoken Hebrew.
The difference is that dialects, Arabic dialects, are very spread on a very large geographic scale.
Correct.
So no way Morocco speaker speak with an Iraqi speaker.
Right.
While Amiya, you cannot write, you cannot put it on script. You cannot study its grammar. So this brings a very problematic gap between spoken language and the literature language or normative language.
Yeah, people don't want to touch it.
And in Hebrew, it's another story. It's the same language. And Israeli knows the norms, knows the good Hebrew, knows we almost don't have dialects. I'm not going to it. There are some dialects, but they are very... A nuance, it's not a real dialect. Now we have socialists like the army. That's another story. So it's a difference. So if you come back to your question, when I studied not only how to write to people, which I knew because I came from the media and I'm a writer and I'm a natural writer, but also because I understood through what people wrote me a lot, not WhatsApp. Mails, emails, the holy email. Every week, I write a column and I got 20, 30, sometimes 100, once the speak was 200 for one column. And there was a reason for this. And so I study so much from what people ask me or react to my writing. And I understood the basic concept of my work. What is the gate for the common person to the language is not syntax, even not morphology, though it's a bit closer, not phonetics, it's words. People love words. People understand that the word have life. Every word, and in Hebrew particularly, have history, beginning from the Bible, Mishnah, through years, or based on the classic language, or based on some foreign language. But it has a story.
Tell me a story of an example, and one I think you'll be able to speak to is the Hebrew word for tomato. So tell me about the root and the emotions that come with it and why that word was chosen.
Well, of course, we don't have tomato in the Bible or in the Mishnah. It's for us. It's new. It's new for the world. Everybody loves tomatoes, and Israelis are crazy for tomatoes. But we didn't have a name. So there are three people arguing about what name will we call tomato. In these fascinating years between the end of the, about 20 years, we call Tchiyat HaLashon, the revival of the Hebrew. It's about 20 years from the end of the 10, 15 years of 19th century to the 10, 15 years of beginning of the 20th century. That was the revival. And most of the new words, important words, was invented there. Words we didn't have and needed. So what for tomato? So Ben Yehuda loved Arabic. So he said in Arabic, it's called Bandura. Bandura is coming from Italy, Italian. Pomodoro becomes Bandura. And he said, let's call it Badura. Well, Badura is not so sexy. Nobody wants to eat Badura. And then some Alexander Zizkin Rabinovich, who was called the old man, Azar, said, let's call it like tomato, Tama, because Tama is like tomato, and it's holy, it's complete, like the tomato. And then came a friend of Ben Yehuda, a poet, Yechiel Michal Pines.
That's another great last name.
Yes, of course. And he suggested Agvania. He said, Agav, Ein, Gimel, Bet, is from the Bible. La'agov means to love. And it's kind of erotic. It's not just platonic. And the French called tomato pomme d'amour, the apple of love. So let's call it in the love, the name of love, Agvania. And it was the name that succeeded also because there was a song, a refrain about the Agvania, written in the beginning of the 20th century. Agvania, Agvania, etmol rak banu leonia. And it begins, and everybody sang it, so it was a big success. And we have Agvania forever.
So that word,
I say the refrains are very important in this revival time, and all along language, refrains, the music, what you call now the music, in Hebrew we call it the zemer. Mm-hmm. Songs that everybody sing, but very important in you know, the life of the Hebrew language. So people love words, and love phrases. Phrases are words combined together. And people love slang so much. Slang is funny. Slang is us. Slang is intimate. Slang is informal. And we, the Israelis, are so informal. What can we do without slang? We will die. So the Israeli slang, and Israeli slang has its history. You know, Yiddish coming into the Hebrew norm, everyday speaking, because you cannot speak Yiddish as a whole in the public domain, but if you cannot come through the door, you will come through the window of slang, etc. The same with Palestinian Arabic. It was so influential. So people love all of this. So, and now to answer your specific question, why do I write dictionary about specific topics? There is a very simple answer. Because we need these dictionaries. I will not write a new dictionary, Hebrew, like Evan Shoshan. Evan Shoshan is great. The people who came after it and before and after him didn't give such a good full dictionary. It's all based on Ben Yehuda dictionary, but it was very limited to, you know, 20th knowledge.
Right. Your work includes context, which I think is really important. Most dictionaries don't. They're just lists of words with the definitions and the translation.
Of course.
You're providing context.
Yes. So first of all, slang dictionary was the first dictionary. And I was asked again and again, what do we lack in the shelf of Hebrew library? And I said, we need a good updated slang dictionary. And then I got one. I won't say names. It was so awful that I said, now I have to do it. Nobody will do it. And it came out in 2005.
I think I know the dictionary you're talking of.
Yes. It's the comprehensive slang dictionary, about close to 10,000 entries. Reviews was so highly praising, and it was like, wow, it was a wow, which I didn't expect so much. So I understood I did the right thing. Now you asked about context. I believe that in a dictionary, you have to give people everything. That's what Evan Shoshan understood. And he did it so well. And even Ben Yehuda in his way. If you give a word or a phrase in a dictionary, you have to answer every question that the reader asks. You are not there to answer him. So you have to understand before what he needs. Mm-hmm. And people want to know the story, not only definition. People know the definition, they don't need for me. For me, they know that kef is fun. That I think tachles is something else in Yiddish. But they want to know where did it come from. Sometimes it's simple, sometimes it's not so simple. If it's from Arabic, I give the Arabic word that it came from. If it's Yiddish, it's the same. If it's a Hebrew word, I give the context. Many words, especially verbs in slang, have many definitions, various definitions, polysemic definitions. And there are some verbs that slang loves. We love some verbs more than the other. Mm-hmm. Most of them violent verbs. You can understand why, maybe.
Right.
For example, dafak.
Right. Multiple meanings with that
multiple
one.
Multiple meaning. Tachan. Tachan. I have 9 for tachan, which to grind. You know, what is grinding? It's not so important. In slang, it's very important. And that was something that I worked a lot. I give a phrase, an utterance, something from the internet, something on the web, how people use it really, not how I think they have to use it. So I found in books, even in poetry, and as I said, in the web, and in newspapers, and when I'm listening to the radio and television, I found for each entry a sentence which includes the entry. And only, I think, 1.5% I couldn't find, so I invented it. And I said, this is invented. But this is very important because only context can really give you the full meaning and use of the word, especially in slang. Yes, for example, it's a bit strange, but slang, you have to lenaked, to punctuate, to put nikud in it. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, people won't.
Right.
We don't know how to read it.
Well, it's like in Arabic, you have to use your hands
to
express something. In Hebrew, like whenever somebody says, you know, if somebody cuts you off in traffic, and it's a podcast, we can say whatever we want, but someone cuts you off in traffic and they say kus immik, just from the Arabic slang, but they don't just say it. They say it under their breath, like kus immik.
Okay.
Yes. It's like you're saying, there's a way that people pronounce
it. They have music. They have a special accent. The accent.
Right.
Where it comes, and it's sometimes not the normative one. Many people, the normative accent is not a normative in slang. And there is music, of course, which you cannot bring in the dictionary. Like you say, neshama is the soul, yes? But when you want to say that somebody is a very good soul, you say neshama, neshama. You say it, you know, with all your... If you want to say something in Yiddish or coming from Yiddish, if you say to somebody, Tieli bari, be like zo, yes, be healthy. You don't expect him to be healthy, you expect him to die. So, but only through music you can understand it. So the what happened to the slang dictionary was that it a year ago, after 20,000 copies, which is a lot in Israel.
You sold 20,000 copies of that dictionary.
Yes.
Wow.
And it's out of order, and I asked him not to print more, which is very strange, because I said there are so many new words in slang. I got thousands of feedbacks to my email from people who read the slang dictionary and wrote me the comments. So I learned so much after it. So I wrote, there is an updated slang dictionary in Ivrit as a book, as an online book. But what happened then was, and I can say because I work with the public, things happen to me all the time because I'm not working in this narrow, important way of the academic, but with all the public. So things happen all the time. Every week, I'm not going to story that happened to me last week, but they are not very, very, well, I give some for as a joke that somebody yesterday wrote me an email and said, there is a new font called Rubik. Is it on your name?
Yeah.
Well, I was flattered and embarrassed. So I said, no, it's not a many. Anyhow, but let's back to some woman came to me and said, we lost our father. I knew his name. He was a very good man in research and a bit like me, not coming from the heart of the academic clique. And she said he wrote, for 10 years, he wrote a dictionary of idioms and phrases that's coming from foreign languages. He studied every one of these idioms and read so many, and he knew many languages, and he died from cancer. And we have a big amount of, a huge amount of material, and nobody want to look at it because it's only material. It's not a book. It's not. They gave it to me for a letter. I wrote them. I signed a letter that I'm going to use it for good purposes and give him credit. And that's all. No money, no very special family. And so I published Milon HaTzerufim, the dictionary of Hebrew-Israeli idioms and phrases, 18,000. I think it includes everything that a Hebrew speaker should know. And also I gave the whole story. Where did it come from? What's the origin? What's the context? A sentence with its use.
Right.
It's about 15 items, not in every, of course, not in every entry, but some entries are very rich with some linguistic comments. This one already, I sold already 22,000, and it's continuing. You don't have to update it. It's
right.
And this is told me how people love phrases and they understand that phrases have a story. So these are the two dictionaries I wrote.
And let me ask you, when people write you on your website and they ask for the root of this word or what it means or where did it come from, how often are you stumped? In English, we say stumped. Like, how often do you not know the answer and you have to go research it?
Well, I don't. The opposite. Even when I know, I go research.
Mm-hmm.
I learned something very important in my work and in life, that when I'm very sure in something, it means that I'm wrong, because it happened to me. Sometimes I was so sure I didn't check, and then I made my mistakes. It's very, very interesting psychology in the psychology aspect. So I even am, I know, and most of the time I know for sure, and I'm right. Now I don't go to libraries. Most of the people don't go to libraries in the universities anyhow, but not me. I'm not part of university now. I worked 17 years in the Open University. So I had a library, but I didn't need it. I have at home a language library, about 300 or 400 books. I buy every book that I need. I have all the dictionaries of all the languages, Hebrew, Spanish, Hebrew, Italian, Hebrew, Russian, Hebrew, Chinese, everything. Mm-hmm. I have and a lot of stuff on the web on my computer. So my life is very easy comparing to Ben Yehuda, who have to write everything by and put it in, you know, little right. boxes.
Have you ever thought about the future of these dictionaries? So like with the slang dictionary, you wrote it in 2005, correct? Or it came out in 2005? I mean, I have to imagine in 20 years, Hebrew slang is going to be very different. Have you thought about
it? Yes, so I told you that I published now an online, which I can update. Mm-hmm. And my dream, now I'm not doing it now for many reasons, but one day I will put it in my site. And I will really update it all the time. Now, I update not the dictionary, but every time that I read, I hear a new slang word, I write about it in my site. So it's there. You know.
Does that ever happen when you're walking around and, you know, you're walking past a cafe and you see two women sitting down talking to each other and you hear something and you've never, you know what it is, but you've never heard it used before? Like,
it happened once. Well, I'm in the center of Tel Aviv. And here, you know, the gay scene is very strong. Sometimes said, I'm straight. So if you're straight, you have to come with a passport to my environment. And there's no problem with it. But I heard two young women going hand by hand, and one said to the other, "Sister, takshivi," in here in English. Mm-hmm. So sister is achoti, you know?
Right.
And now it's coming, achi, it's my friend. Actually, all in slang. Achi, actually, achoti, and now sister. And there is also och. Och is, in the gay scene, a very extrovert gay men, women, what you call,
right.
How do you? So they have a dictionary called Evan Shoshana Dictionary, which I wrote a lot in my site about it. Listen, most of my stuff is not from listening, though I listen all the time. I listen to the public, but not through going in the street. It's not
right. It's just a good way to notice how things are evolving.
Yes, but I think my ear is focused on everything that happened in language that should tell me a story about a new word, a new use, a new, you know, subject in language, semantic field. My ear rings. There is a ring in my ear.
Right. So do you love writing the process of writing these dictionaries? How hard is that? Do you love that process, or do you just love the outcome and what you're? And
I just love the outcome. The process is awful.
Right. How do you even get started? I mean, what is that? How do you even do that?
Well, now I have, not only a writer, but I'm also Yeke. German Jews are Yekes, yes. Mm-hmm. So I think in a very
systematic way, I guess.
Systematic way. Somehow there is a connection. I don't know how my brain functions. I don't understand it. But it functions in a holistic way. So I see in everything that happened, I see the systematic aspect and the imaginary creative aspect in the same glance, same minute. I'm very systematic. Now, what you have to do in dictionaries, and that's why many people who want to write a dictionary fail, is when you write a dictionary, you have to do your errors before you begin work. It's not trial and error. Trial and error, you won't go out of, because if you make an error and you go through the dictionary to the first 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, oh, I have to change it, you have to begin everything from the beginning. So it's very important to make the right decisions in the beginning. And then it's very hard work. It took me about 2 years, the slang dictionary. I continued everything else, but about... And when I'm working on a dictionary, it's 24/7. I do other things, but every minute I go to it, I work to 2 o'clock at night, because the only thing that really connected to your question, the only way to continue and finish is the concept of the complete dictionary on your shelf and on the shops.
I know you're a humble guy, but do you consider your work taking its place amongst, you know, the other great Hebrew language works of Ben Yehuda and the others?
Yes. Yes, yes. Well, there was a Google in 2011. The Google have a site for the language year. Mm-hmm. And they brought six names of important people, including Ben Yehuda and Evan Shoshan. And I was one of the six. Oh. So I think it well makes the linguistics very angry. But what could I do? It's not. I didn't say it. But I think in my line of work, I'm important. But of course, research, the Academy of Language is very important. And most of the linguists are doing important things, which I use. I can say that a part of, even big part of the linguistic work, I don't find interest in. I find interest in what tells me the life, the essence of the life of Hebrew language mm-hmm. today and in the years. And that's why I wrote, if you want to speak about my children's books, you have to ask, but my next book is not a children's book. It's a book called Speaking in the Language of the Bible. Medabrim Bisfat HaTanach. We gave it the name in English, Old Language, New Language, the Biblical Foundations of Modern Hebrew. And also I felt the book is needed on the shelf.
Right.
I'm not going after somebody who did it. Everybody is speaking about the biblical language. There are huge piles of important researchers, and I read a lot, but I'm sure not everything. There's beginning of important research about modern Hebrew, last 20, 30 years. Before it, it was almost nobody did it. But combining them together and tell once to the Hebrew speakers public, what are the apparatus? What are the ways, the roots? How does it work that an ancient language in a book with less than 2,000 words is providing the foundations for modern 21st century language? How does it happen? So each one of my 20 chapters in the book give another aspect of this story, some more linguistic, some more historic, more cultural. For example, a chapter about secularization of the language, a chapter about animals, flora and fauna in the Bible and today. How did we take this, the terms, the names of right. the animals,
and etc. 65% of modern Hebrew comes from biblical Hebrew, correct?
Well, to be precise, 65% of the language that we use for our needs. It's about, in every language, you don't need more than 2,000 words to be a good speaker and writer. All the other are a bonus, you know, for many, many aspects. So in English, you have 100,000, million, I don't know. In Hebrew, we have 60,000, 70,000 words, but we need 2,000, about. In this 2,000, which is not only everyday speech, but also newspapers, books, lectures, teaching, everything, are from the Bible directly. Only about 15% from the sages, from the Mishnah and the... And modern Hebrew, who gave so many new words, most of them are not part of everyday life, but, you know, more professional, etc. So this is the big story, and that's why I love to write this book so much, because the Bible, the biblical Hebrew, is everywhere. Every point that you touch, you find it. And I had so many surprises along...
When is this book going to come out, or when do you plan on publishing it? 1 month. Okay.
And I worked on it two last years. In the beginning, I made a table of all the words in the Bible, with some details. And then from this, I made cuts. For example, animals. So I can find 200 animals in the Bible.
Right.
I have a chapter about irony from the irony shift, I call it, from the biblical world to our modern world. I have it on my table. So this was the beginning. And then I read hundreds of articles written that helped me. And it was written and edited.
I know that there's some people or some scholars who think of, you know, the Hebrew language could be corrupted by English being introduced to it, by French, by Russian, all these different things that compose modern Hebrew. But I never saw it that way. I think it's more of a natural process of any language. And especially historically, if you look at Hebrew, it's a combination of things. It's like you said, it's the Judean dialect combined with whatever the Israelite dialect was, with whatever.
And Persian came into
Persian. What are your thoughts on
that? In my book about the Bible, I write about the influence of foreign language on the biblical language. You know, Hebrew was not in jump, parachuted from...
Right, didn't come out of a vacuum.
Some people think it was invented by God, and well, I'm not coming into this belief. It's okay. Everybody can believe it, but of course it's nonsense. It came out from other languages, like every language. Every big language began somewhere in some other languages and separated. And one day or some generations, it became an independent language. And we don't know in which moment exactly, including Hebrew. But we find Akkadian, Assyrian, Aramaic, Egyptian, Phoenician, everything, not Arabic, in the biblical and also in the post-biblical Hebrew. Modern Hebrew, we are immigrants. All of our parents are immigrants. The people who invented New Hebrew are immigrants. They came with other two languages, the Jewish language and the language in the States they came from.
Right.
Now, speaking about pure language, which was an idea of even in the past and today, is absolutely nonsense. There is no such thing as pure language.
Right.
And the most impure language on earth is English, which takes from everybody. And I think they feel that they are very good language. They don't have problem with the identity of language. Today, what we call purists are very few, and they try to... I think that they are annoying persons. Well, I think that finding a good Hebrew word that we lacked and succeeding to put it in use is very good. But if not, nothing happened to the language. It's not the point. What keeps the language steady is morphology, is grammar, not syntax. Syntax is very dynamic. Phonetics is absolutely. But grammar, morphology, is so strict. It's such a skeleton of the language, so strong, we don't change it, we don't touch it.
Well, and I heard you say one time that if you see it just life in general, if you don't change, you die. Is that true for the Hebrew language too? If it doesn't continue and change, it would die out again, wouldn't it?
Yes, but there is no chance that it will change.
Right.
The miracle, it was not changed for so many years and survived, because it was a holy language and it was traditional. But now in the modern world, of course, Hebrew will live as long as the state of Israel will live. If the state of Israel will not survive, I hope it won't happen, of course, and the Jews will scatter again along the diasporas, Hebrew will die for good.
And let me ask you, how important is, in the history of Israel and also now, how important is the Hebrew language when it comes to the Israeli identity and national unity?
Let's put it from both sides. First of all, of course it is. And it is declared like this. And the interest in language is very strong. And there is the Hebrew language day, which is a big feast every year. And a lot of publicity and really, it's a big love. At the other hand, people are speaking all the time, we are going to die. And opposing my what I said before, but feeling there is a big threat on Hebrew. What are the threats? Some people say slang is a big threat. Of course, it's nonsense. And I explain to everybody that slang is not a threat. Slang is a need, is a part for some functions of the language. We speak so many foreign words. Loaziot, milim loaziot. Of course we do. Because we don't have a word for humor, humor. We don't have one. Funny. We have the word latzon from the Bible. It's not used. So we say humor. We say sport. There's no Hebrew word for sport. Of course, it's a language.
Actually, I actually know it. It goes a sport.
Yeah,
so you just say it with an Israeli accent, and then it becomes a Hebrew word.
Okay, but also when I say sportivi, okay, this with morphemes of ev, so it's absolutely right. Hebrew. Of course, grammar is not only steady, but it helps us to to make foreign words Jewish.
So if better. Say that Ben Yehuda never came along and Hebrew was never revived and the language of the state of Israel was German or Yiddish or was just whatever it ended up being the strongest language, do you think that would have changed Israel's history? I mean, in terms of the ability, the strong national
union? It could not work. It would not work. First of all, because it was so against the ideology of coming back to the land of the Bible. And that what Ben Yehuda understood before anybody else. That's why he was a genius. But step by step, everybody understood it. Second, what language? People are coming from Galicia, Russia, Germany, and Yemen, and then United States, and later from Morocco. Would they speak German? I don't think so. Or Iraq. We need a common language because we are so scattered. So, and what language do you teach the students or the young pupil? One language that fits everybody. So on the practical side and on the ideological side, there was no other possibility, no option.
But one of Herzl's ideas was to just let the strongest language win.
He didn't know Hebrew and he couldn't imagine that it will succeed. And I understand him. Said, I cannot
buy a ticket
for the train in Hebrew. So today he can buy a ticket to the train in Hebrew, but the train never comes on time. That's another story.
Right.
So, but of course he couldn't imagine it. And not only him. In the end of his life, he began to understand Ben Yehuda's ideas, but he didn't think about it so much. But what happened in Israel was very simple. First Aliyah Rishona, Ben Yehuda included, they spoke about Hebrew, but it was very small, with very small success. Second Aliyah came, and with schools, with newspapers, with the passion for the Zionist ideology, they materialized the idea of making Hebrew we don't call modern Hebrew spoken language. Of course it is, but it's not the whole story. We call it all around language or ofefet kol. I don't know what's
surrounds everything. Yeah.
Surrounds everything. Every aspect of life is in Hebrew. And this idea was fulfilled. But not in the pure way. It cannot be in the pure way and don't have to be in the pure way, but in the natural and the right way. And that people feel that so many aspects of Zionism are not in the good route, or we have and we argue about everything, but not about language.
So I want to close it out here, even though I literally have pages of questions for you in front of me. So we're going to have to do a follow-up in order to get to everything that I want to get to. But if people want to find your website, they need to go to www.ruvik.co.il. And on your website, you have your blog. It's all in Hebrew, so they have to be Hebrew speakers. But you have your blog or your, all the articles.
I have about 14 categories right. in questions, my articles, other people's articles, stories of words, and also a memorial for my brother.
Great. And you also have, there's a link on there to websites to buy your books.
Yes, every book you can try and buy it in the Israeli online shops. And also my way to live out of language, because language is also my economic financial base, right. is by lectures. I lecture a lot all around the country by demand. To people, to modern, normal people, not almost not to, you know, academic knassim. And I also write every Saturday. I give 5 minutes about the world in the radio, in the journal of the week. I give the story of the world of the week. Mm-hmm. You know, current right. affairs, words. It's also going from some years. And I also write in the Malingo Rav Milim, Morphix, connected to Morphix,
right.
a blog, which I take the same topics, but give it in a new way of showing it.
So thank you very much for agreeing to do this. I know you didn't have to, and I'm a stranger, but this has been fascinating for me. And I hope you continue on your path and continue on your passion, because like I said, I think you're taking your place amongst the Hebrew greats. And I want you to email me when your new book is out. And I definitely want to have you back on if you're willing to come back on, because there's probably another hour and a half of content that I need to get out of you.
Okay.
So I hope you have a great day.
And your question was so good. So
thank you.
Me to express my thoughts.
So we'll talk soon. And thank you again.